bird note. Ah, mallards at your local pond. They're our largest dabbling duck, and among ducks, the most abundant species. They're the source of all domestic ducks, except the Muscovy. There's a female making herself heard. But does it seem that all the brightly colored male mallards have disappeared? By now, the male duck's need for fancy feathers to attract the females has passed. The male mallards have molted, dropping their bright green, reddish, black, and white feathers and replacing them with mottled brown ones. Changing into more subdued colors for the months of summer helps camouflage the male ducks, protecting them from predators. Come fall, the mallards will molt again and return to the colorful dandies we remember. In the meantime, while all the mallards look like brownish females, there's one way to distinguish males from females. Look closely at the bill. The male's bill is dull yellow, while the female's is orange marked with black. And watch to see which duck is quacking. That's the female mallard. Male mallards make a more subdued and raspy call, mostly when courting or greeting, or when they feel threatened. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
Mindfulness is both profound and potent. Our guests today suggest that it is not about holding the busy world at bay. It's to cultivate a more alive, responsive, effective, and warm-hearted way of being within the world as it already exists and within a life you already live. Today we'll be exploring how to find composure right in the midst of the storm, and ways to integrate mindfulness into our daily life with our guest, Mark Lesser. Mark Lesser is a Zen teacher who leads trainings and talks worldwide. He has led mindfulness and emotional intelligence programs at many of the world's leading businesses and organizations, including Google, Genentech, and Kaiser. He's currently CEO of ZBA Associates, a company providing mindfulness-based leadership trainings and creating community by supporting ongoing groups. Previously, he served as CEO and co-founder of Search Inside Yourself Leadership Institute, whose core programs he helped develop within Google. Mark was a resident of the San Francisco Zen Center for 10 years and former director of Tassajara Zen Mountain Center. He's the author of Less, Accomplishing More by Doing Less, Know Yourself, Forget Yourself, and Seven Practices of a Mindful Leader, Lessons from Google and a Zen Monastery Kitchen. Join us for the next hour as we explore how mindfulness practice can help us meet the challenges of life more skillfully, whether it's at work, at home, or out in the world in general, with our guest, Mark Lesser. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. Mark, welcome.
Thank you, Justine.
I'd love to just talk. I know that you lived at the Zen Center for a while, and so you were practicing Zen meditation. And then you went to Tazahara, this retreat center, a Zen retreat center, and somehow ended up as chief cook and bottle washer in the kitchen and heading up a whole team. And you learned about leadership, and I mean, you're really in the fire in the kitchen. I mean, it's getting off the cushion now. You're really in it, and use all the principles you've learned sitting on your cushion. I'd love for you to tell that story.
Yeah. No, it was amazing. I was 24 years old my first summer at Tassajara, and my job was as dishwasher. And at that time, the dishwashing was done in the kitchen, all by hand. This was in the summertime when there were 70 or 80 overnight guests every night. So it was that was my first experience of the kitchen. But what, even then, I was so. In fact, my very first experience of I arrived at Tassajara, went to the courtyard, which is right next to the kitchen. And these two men kind of walked out the door of the kitchen onto this platform, and they were laughing, just laughing and playing, and it turned that was actually at the time the head cook and the assistant cook at that time, who I didn't know then, who've now they've become some close friends, but there's something about the amount of laughter and love and connection that I felt from day one, you know, as I entered Tassajara. And then I ended up working in the kitchen the following 90-day practice period. I was on the crew chopping vegetables. And somehow I got asked to be the baker during the summer. I was a Tassajara bread baker. And a couple of years later, I found myself working on the crew. And I got asked to be the assistant to the head cook, which is a great job. It's kind of like the operations manager. You're sort of directing all of the traffic, keeping things, everything running, training people. Just a great role. And then the following year, I got asked to be the head cook, which is more kind of a leadership position, management, ordering food, budgets. But all of that, just something about a group of people, like sometimes there'd be, you know, maybe 15 people working side by side with integrating, right? Chopping vegetables, sometimes for 2 days ahead, sometimes a group of people at, you know, on the fire, cooking and serving up those meals, baking, all interwoven. Sometimes things go wrong. You know, the potatoes aren't cooked and you're supposed to be serving up the meal. Or the vegetable that you thought was the dinner vegetable isn't in the walk-in. And it was hot these Tassajara days with no air conditioning in the kitchen. So it was as intense, I think, as any kind of commercial kitchen. High expectations about Tassajara's known in the summer. Gourmet, vegetarian meals. Now, it has so many pieces to it. There's also, I think, a very well thought through, developed training about how things were done from the knives. You would never see a knife in the sink. Like even today in my house, sometimes guests will come over and they'll take a knife and put it in, like it almost hurts my body to see a knife in the, like, no, knives do not go in the sink. You clean that knife, you dry that knife, and it goes in a very particular place. I know where that knife is, and I'm never going to be surprised to reach in and cut my hands. And so,
yeah.
I mean, but also like how the garlic is chopped and how the, you know, how you do things and how things are cooked.
So how did you all work together then in that high stress situation?
Well, I think there was this interesting combination of the training about how to do things, combined with that this was primarily about practice. it was the primary aim was not about producing great food. It was about producing great people. And like, this was training in knowing yourself and in going beyond yourself. Training in collaboration and in serving something bigger than you, which meant bumping up against your own small ideas and sometimes bumping up against, what do you do when you get angry, when you go over and someone's in your space? Whether, hey, I'm baking bread in this space, yes, and what do you, what do you mean you're making chocolate cake in this space? This is, and that over and over again, you're summoned to bring up that sense of kindness over and over,
because
right in the midst.
There was a culture there.
That's right.
Of loving kindness, and that's what like the overall.
You cut right through, you know, to the, you know, the punchline is that, you know, in my book, the first line in my book is, culture eats strategy for breakfast, and which is great that we're talking about the kitchen and food, so it all kind of fits together. But yes, there was a very kind of basic assumption that you were there to practice. You were there to practice kindness, curiosity. You were there to bump up against the contradiction of, you're a human being and you have strong emotions and it's hot and you're tired and like, work faster, you know, like work, like it's not always, it's not, you know, people think, oh, mindfulness. No, well, yeah, no, like, cut those freaking carrots. I need you to cut them faster. And like, can you work, you know, like, I can show you how to do them faster. I can show you how to focus. Oh, this is the best you're doing? Great. We need more people, right? I need another person right now because I need those carrots now.
Right. So working with what is.
That's right.
What is. And right. Your book, Seven Practices of a Mindful Leader, you have these seven practices, mm-hmm. these seven principles, so to speak, mm-hmm. of mindfulness. Mm-hmm. And it came from an odd source, mm-hmm. I felt.
Yeah, this was, you know, I found myself, you know, what, 20 years later than when I was in this, or more, from the Tassara kitchen, teaching mindfulness inside of Google. And I felt very, you know, very consciously and maybe not so consciously that, like, the ongoing question was, how do we bring that culture that I felt like I got to be part of and that it was in my body in some way and that Google wanted it, and that Google, maybe they didn't even know that they wanted it. They wanted mindfulness and with a kind of depth and a kind of precision that was there in Google, which actually was a big stretch for me to, like, it was a lot of work about how do these things translate into a corporate environment and an engineering environment, a high-powered work environment. But again, as you were saying, it was about tapping into the culture and tapping into the basic, I think, needs and challenges that we all humans have, whether you're a Google engineer or a Tassara bread baker. I call it the dirty little secret of the business world. It's all human beings. So bringing this program, mindfulness programs, into Google, then looking at how to scale it, how do you train Google engineers to be mindfulness teachers? And the story that you're referring to is, I brought in a good friend of mine, a man named Norman Fisher, who's one of the world's leading Zen teachers, and who was part of the early days of working with me inside of Google. And we were training a group, and during this one day training, I looked at the agenda for this day and it said Norman gives talk on mindfulness. And I had a feeling no one had really communicated it to Norman. So I very delicately pointed to the agenda, showed it to Norman. He very nonchalantly made some notes and taught these seven practices.
I want you to flesh that out for us in just a bit, but I want to remind our listeners that I'm here with Mark Lesser. He's the author of Seven Practices of a Mindful Leader, Lessons from Google and a Zen Monastery Kitchen. And if you want to know more about the work of Mark, you can go to his website, marklesser.net. And he spells his name MarkLesser, marklesser.net. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. And Mark, you were just sharing the story of being with Norman Fisher, and suddenly he's going to have to speak, and you knew that he hadn't really been informed that he was going to speak. And so what happened at that point?
Yeah, Norman got out a piece of paper and a pen, made a few notes, and launched into giving a talk to these about a dozen, mostly Google engineers, on what are the core values, the core practices that you need to know or need to work to embody in order to be a mindfulness teacher. And he launches into these seven practices. Love the work. Do the work. Don't be an expert. Connect to your pain. Connect to the pain of others. Depend on others. And keep making it simpler. And I was totally entranced and bowled over when and then he spoke for a few minutes about each one. I wrote them down. I actually kind of made a chart of them and put them on everyone's desk in the company. There were about 20 people at the time, with a note saying, these express the values for how the kind of culture that I want us to work together. And then I realized that they even go beyond that. They were like, this is how I want to live my life. And I began writing, and I began, you know, I was out there a fair amount at that time as the CEO of the Search Inside Yourself Leadership Institute doing talks. And I found myself doing talks about these seven practices. And then little by little, it started to emerge as, oh, I think this is a book. And then I started to feel funny, like I needed to get Norman's permission. And this was now a couple of years had gone by. And I called Norman and said, Norman, this might be a difficult conversation. I don't know, but I'm calling to tell you I'm writing about these seven practices that you spoke about at Google, and I'd like to write a book about it, and I need your okay. And Norman, of course, says, "What seven practices? I have no idea what you're talking about." I read Norman the seven practices. He said, "Those are really good. You should write a book about those, and good luck, and send me a copy." So it was very, he really so did. That really was off the cuff, Norman talking about those. And it's also funny, my world. I actually gave a talk yesterday at Google about these. And I used to spend a lot of time teaching at Google, not a lot in recent years, some. And then I'm teaching tomorrow with Norman at Green Gulch. And it was funny, he has a new book out, and I said, Norman, let's have the theme be about your book. No, let's have it be about your book.
So
we're kind of combining.
Oh, sweet. Mindfulness, we're in a kind of time, an era of, I'm going to call it Mac mindfulness. Mm-hmm. I mean, that a lot of people are teaching mindfulness, and I'm sure some of it is very valuable, but a lot of it kind of is going for, let's say, self-improvement, mm-hmm. or they have a certain goal in mind. I think that you're talking about something slightly different or broader or deeper. What can you say?
You know, I can't tell if it's my own strength or weakness, but I have more of a, like, I think for the most part, it's almost all of it, I think, is good and beneficial. Some of it may be more surfacey or more goal-oriented, as you said. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I think it's getting people in the door, getting people to think about things that they might not have thought about. this realm of mindfulness is incredibly deep and broad and vast. The Zen tradition is just one piece of it, and the Zen tradition is vast. And I've been studying Zen for 40 years now, and I really do feel like I'm just scratching the surface. So there is this incredible depth and breadth to this thing that we call mindfulness practice, but I don't want people to feel like, therefore, it's unapproachable. My goal with the work that I do is to make these things as accessible. So I think it's beautiful to bring these into the corporate world. Now, there's many motivations, you know, from the unwholesome, you know, to, oh, these are going to improve corporate profits. Well, that's not why I'm there. That might get me in the door. I'm okay coming in the door. And I feel like I can then present these trainings in a very wide way so that some people who just want to reduce stress more, these practices can help. Want to be a better leader, want to be more flexible, want to be able to go home and turn it off so you can be with your family. Great. I think these things can help. Want to work on, you know, going beyond self and tapping into something that's much wider and deeper, and want to embody a sense of what freedom is. Okay, let's work on that level too. That level really excites me.
And that level is a lifetime level.
Definitely.
I mean, it's not like, okay, I'm going to arrive someday. It just keeps expanding or deepening, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, that's the beauty of all of these practices, but very specifically, right? Practice number three, you know, don't be an expert. Right?
That is so important. When I don't be an expert. Now, how did that come up with mindfulness practice? It was wonderful.
Yeah. Well, again, I think from the perspective of if you're training to be a teacher of mindfulness, realize you're not going to be an expert. You're not going to be, because, you know, in some way, mindfulness and these practices is like, the question is the practice of being fully human. How can we be fully human? How can we show up in relationship? How do we show up when the potatoes are not cooked in the kitchen, or the code that you just wrote sucks and it's causing all kinds of things to fall apart? Or how do you show up when you're in conflict, you know, whether it's at work or at home? Like, this human, how do you deal with success? How do you deal with failure? How do you deal with change and unknown? This amazing thing of time and consciousness.
Well, that's an important point, I think, that you just touched on. Because to be human is to fail. And mm-hmm. I know that your work in improv theater has helped you a bit to work to understand about failure. And there's something that is taught in some improv classes is to really take on failure and to learn what they call the circus bow. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The circus bow. Mm-hmm. So when you fail, you do a great big bow. When the woman falls off the horse and she's not supposed to, she turns to the audience and she just takes a big bow.
Yeah.
Because that's going to come up for us, and we think we're going to have to be an expert all the time, especially when we're in leadership.
Yeah, that's part of this practice of don't be an expert. And someone reminded me that I used to do that pretty regularly, the circus bow at Google. I used to get people to stand up and throw their arms up in the air and say, I failed. And then it becomes like you start to notice that, of course, we don't like failure, but even little things like, you know, you accidentally spill your coffee. Well, instead of like cursing and it's shifting relationship, you know. And you could also say, you could do the same thing about change and I changed. Like, wow, I look in the mirror and I'm not the same person. How did that happen?
Where did those wrinkles go? Where did that gray hair come from? Yeah. Or lack of hair?
Yeah. I'm so, you know, I was the younger brother. I'm so sort of programmed. I was always the youngest person in the room. And I was in Google yesterday and looked around and said, I might be the oldest person in this room. How did that happen? But I'm not worried. They're all going to get to, you know, if they're lucky, they're going to get to experience aging.
One of the topics that you, or capacities, we'll call it, one of the capacities that you talk about in the practices of being mindful is generative listening. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And how important that is mm-hmm. for us. And I'm not sure which of the seven practices it goes with.
Yeah. Well, that's going to take a little bit of unpacking. In some way, and I think what I've been realizing is the practice of listening, in a way, holds all the practices. Mm. And in some way is probably... built in, integrated, and primary. Again, it's, you know, we humans, it's so easy, right? We hear the word listening, and probably most people say, oh, come on. Tell me something I don't already know. But I find listening is much more complex and challenging and profound than you might think. Like, it's a little bit like one of the examples I like to give is, you know, if you see a waterfall in a creek, our minds immediately identify it as, oh, that's a waterfall. Like, well, there's no such thing. It's this thing. It's this change in dimension and shape in the water, and if you just curious about, well, what is that? What if there wasn't this? As soon as we name it, suddenly we become an expert. We know what that waterfall is. Listening's like that too. Even talking about listening or listening to another person. Oh, I already know what that other person's going to say. So listening means, and this don't be an expert, and listening is actually having the courage to not know, to not know what you're going to say, to not know what I'm going to say. This is actually why I took improv classes, because I was terrified. I was starting to be asked to do talks, and the idea of being in front of people without a script, I used to make multiple scripts and put them in all my pockets just in case I lost one. And so it was so great to have to fail and have to be in a place where I had to listen in a different way. So I think it's probably in the chapter on Do the Work, but I have to say I'm not completely sure, where I describe four levels of listening. Not listening, which is the most popular. Listening for content. Listening for feelings. And then this fourth level, which generative listening, or sometimes I call it intuitive listening. Listening beyond the words and feelings.
Thank you. I'm here with Mark Lesser. He's the author of Seven Practices of a Mindful Leader, Lessons from Google and a Zen Monastery Kitchen. If you want to know more about his work, go to his website, marklesser.net. And he spells his name MarkLesser, marklesser.net. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. One of the things that I loved, you related mindfulness a bit with love of self and love of others. You kind of used the word love, mindfulness and love. You kind of coupled those together. And you talk about four qualities of love. And that popped out at me, Mark, for a bit, that I hadn't heard of mindfulness being related to love.
Yeah. It's interesting that I remember someone talking about, like, why, when you look at especially Buddhist texts, Zen texts, Buddhist texts, that you don't see you don't see the word compassion or the word love used very much. And I think the reason for that is it's assumed.
Hmm.
It's in the culture. It's in the water. It's like, it's just